Well, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31, and it's March 10th, and we're going to talk some more about muscles today. And before we do that, let's look at the schedule first. All right, as I'm pulling up the schedule, I'll ask, do we have any news from SI? Nice. Okay, so you might have a review on Friday. Okay, and there's some pertinent information regarding your SI location, right, and time? Yeah, on the board. Nice. So let's see. We're at the 10th, yeah, and indeed, March 17th, we have exam 2. The chapters on exam 2 will be 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. So hopefully you got all those study guides printed out and looking at all that good information. Okay, but the schedule here is erroneous because you don't have practicums next week, right? So practicum 2 is not on the 17th or 19th. It's on the following week, 24th or 26th. So in lab, we're going to have review periods. So I'm sure everybody can get 110% on that practicum coming up because now you know what they're like and how to study for it, and you got plenty of time in lab to study, right? Okay. Any questions regarding the schedule or SI? New questions? What about what we covered last time? Any questions on what we covered last time? It was, I'm not sure if you guys have taken a biology class, so it might seem kind of strange material because it wasn't really anatomy. It was more like physiology. How does a muscle contract? So make sure that you can break a muscle down into its building blocks. So, I don't know, let's see if I can figure out how to do this. So you got a whole big muscle, right? How does your body put a big muscle together? What's a building block of a whole big muscle? Or if you look at a muscle, you can break it down into fascicles. Yeah, you can break it down into fascicles. And what can you break a fascicle down into? Uh-oh, am I going to have to look? I need help. Help me. A fascicle, what's the building block of a fascicle? Yeah, muscle fiber. And what's another name for muscle fiber? A cell, right? A muscle cell and a muscle fiber are exactly the same thing. All right, and should we stop there? No, we should not, because there's fine structure inside every cell. What do we call the organelle for contraction? Yeah, the myofibrils, and they're very long and narrow. What is the repeating unit in a myofibril called? And it's the structural and functional unit of contraction. If you know how that one piece works, you know how the whole myofibril works, you know how the whole fiber works, you know how the whole muscle, all the fascicles, how they work. What is that thing? Yeah, the sarcomere is the structural and functional unit of contraction, at least in voluntary muscle and in cardiac muscle. All right, but you should know some pieces of a sarcomere. And I'm thinking of the proteins that are inside a sarcomere. So what would you need to build a sarcomere? You would need actin and myosin. Yeah, we call those myofilaments. So you'd need a thick myofilament and a thin myofilament. And guess what? I think that's where we stop right there. Okay, you don't have to know any of those other pieces of myosin, except for maybe a head group that's on a myosin molecule. And remember last time we talked about how a muscle contracts? And so I have a couple markers right here. One could be actin, one could be myosin. And which one of these two markers shortens as a sarcomere gets shorter? None of them. Well, how would you explain that to me? Because I just don't see it. Oh, they just slide together like that. We call that the sliding filament mechanism, right? And that myosin, say, is going to pull on an actin molecule. Actin is attached to the Z-disc. So let's take a look at this animation right here. And you can get a better appreciation of that sarcomere. Let's see if it's going to load. Looks like it's loading. Good. It's paused. Nice. Okay. And I think I'm going to go to 1 and 1. All right, so here we have a muscle cell, and here's the cell membrane. Anybody remember what we call the cell membrane on a skeletal muscle cell? Yeah, here's a sarcolemma. And then I see this big space going way down into the interior of a cell. Anybody remember what this thing is? Yeah, that's the T-tubule. And remember, the surface of a muscle cell can conduct the electrical information. So we're going to have electrical information coming from the neuromuscular junction. And it would stay on the surface of the cell, but this muscle cell has these T-tubules that can take that electrical signal deep into the muscle. And it's going to go right between a couple endoplasmic reticulums. Now, are these going to be smooth or rough endoplasmic reticulums? Yeah, these are smooth. And what can you tell me? What's the special function of smooth ER in a skeletal muscle cell? Okay. And one thing I don't want you to emphasize is lipid synthesis. That's another reason why it's there. It stores calcium ions. So these things are loaded with calcium ions. There are pumps that pump calcium into the endoplasmic reticulum. And as a matter of fact, we call these the sarcoplasmic reticulum. This area where there's two cisternae of a sarcoplasmic reticulum and a T-tubule, sometimes we call that a triad, right here. Okay, and if we were now to look inside a myofibril, I see this thing. Now, what am I looking at here? All right, I tell you what is this thing? Yeah, it's a Z-disc, Z-band, here's another one. So those are the endpoints of a sarcomere. And then we see the proteins, the myofilaments inside the sarcomere. This one that I'm pointing to right now, this is a good trick question because it's not illustrated by the correct geometry necessarily in terms of thick or thin, so you can't tell which one is thick and which one is thin. But where I have the cursor, which one is this? That's myosin, or the thick filament. On the thick filament, we have these head groups, right, that can, under certain circumstances, reach up and grab hold of this actin molecule. All right, so here's a muscle at rest, and it hasn't been stimulated. So I think this video just shows excitation-contraction coupling, how the cell gets excited, how that nerve impulse actually flows over the surface of a muscle cell. So let's see if we put this in motion, what do we find? There's that electrical signal. Right, coming from the neuromuscular junction, goes down deep inside the cell, past the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when it does, guess what's released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum?
Calcium,
that's right. And calcium then is going to be at a really high concentration near the reticulum, and then it's just going to move by diffusion around all of these oh, look at that. There's all the calcium moving, right, just by diffusion. That doesn't require any energy. And it's going to bind to some pieces of the actin molecule. It doesn't bind to myosin, but calcium binds to actin. Right? And so here is an illustration of just this little area of the sarcomere. So down here on the bottom, I see a myosin. And these are the head groups that can extend and flex. And then up over here is actin. And you see a couple other molecules on actin. We have troponin, and these are in your notes, but they're not in your textbook, so you don't really have to know this for this class, but I want you to see how important calcium is. Calcium is going to bind to this troponin, and when it does, it's going to change the conformation of tropomyosin, and you can see tropomyosin kind of winding around all over the actin molecule. Okay, and right now, it is covering up, or it's hiding the binding site for this myosin head group. So myosin can't bind to actin because tropomyosin is in the way. When calcium binds to troponin, that pulls tropomyosin out of the way, and then this head group can attach to myosin. And if there's ATP present, then cross-bridge cycling will take place. And we talked about that last time, where the head group attaches and then flexes, and then ATP binds, and then it's released, right? And that process goes over and over and over again. So let's just see maybe the last part of this little animation. Yeah, here are some individual proteins that are all laid out in a nice linear fashion. These are the globular actin molecules. Okay, here's that calcium binding to troponin, and watch what happens. It pulls on troponin, which then pulls on tropomyosin, and guess what we see now? This is where the tropomyosin was, covering up these binding sites for myosin, but now they're available. So this head group can reach right up and attach itself to this actin molecule, like so. You see the binding sites right there? So it's going to attach, forms that cross bridge, and then look what happens. The head group flexes, and it pulls the actin molecule over the myosin. Right, so it's pulling the actin molecule, but what is the actin molecule attached to? The Z-disc, so it's actually pulling the ends of the sarcomere together on both the left and the right side of the sarcomere. And if ATP is present, then this will happen over and over and over again. Probably not shown on this particular illustration. All right, so that's what we call excitation-contraction coupling. I tried to describe that. I don't think I could describe it as well as this video. Okay, so I think that shows pretty much everything we wanted to see. But here is just a little zoomed-in region. And again, we see actin and myosin and how ATP is necessary. There's that calcium signal. You should know where calcium comes from. All right, so calcium is important for muscle contraction. Muscles can't contract without it. And you see why right here. Okay, and then here is the sarcomere from Z-disc to Z-disc. When this inorganic phosphate is released, that causes the flexing of that head group. Okay, ADP is released. Now, these things are stuck together. The myosin and actin are stuck together. So what's necessary? So now the muscle has contracted, right? But myosin now is stuck together with actin. And what is the molecule that's necessary for that myosin to release actin? ATP, that's right. So this muscle will stay contracted even if there's no ATP in the cell, right? But if it is a nice, healthy, living cell, when ATP binds, then it's going to release from actin and go back to this extended state. All right, so hopefully, I haven't seen this in a couple years. Let's see what happens. Oh, yeah, there's that ATP. Where's it going? Ah, the myosin head group. See it release right there? Okay. And then that ATP is going to be broken down into ADP and inorganic phosphate. That energy then causes that conformation change for that myosin head group to go into that extended position. And since calcium is still here, right, this can now bind again to actin and repeat that cycle over and over and over again. As soon as this calcium molecule goes away, then cross-bridge cycling is going to stop and the muscle relaxes when ATP is present. Okay, so you have a little bit better idea of how this cross-bridge attaches to that actin molecule. Okay, that's pretty nice to see. Any questions on that? So I think we mentioned this last time. You know, a couple areas where calcium should be at a high concentration in order for your body to function properly. And can you name one location that's not muscle? Bones, that's right. And muscle is the second one. And as we get older, we lose calcium from our body. Where would you put calcium if you had a choice? Into muscle so that your muscles could contract, or into bones so that you have nice strong bones? Muscle, yeah, so that you can breathe and move around, right? And that's why, as we get older, we lose bone density, right? What do we call that? Osteoporosis, right? Okay. And we're going to see a couple other places, especially when we get into the nervous system, where calcium is used as well. So calcium is a nice signaling system inside this muscle cell, and it's going to be used in other locations as well. Okay. All right, so what do we want to look at? Okay, so let's move on to some gross anatomy of muscle. All right, where do we have some gross anatomy of muscle? Oh, this is looking good here. Put that away. Sometimes we will classify muscle by its shape. Okay, and sometimes they're named by their shape. So if you understand that nomenclature, you don't have to memorize every particular muscle in your body. And so the first one we're going to look at is a circular skeletal muscle. And a circular skeletal muscle is called an orbicularis. Here is an example of a nice circular skeletal muscle. This is under voluntary control. Here's one around the mouth, so we call this orbicularis oris. And there's another one around the eye. That's an orbicularis, but that's not going to be the oris because the oris is down here. That's going to be the oculi, orbicularis oculi muscle around both eyes. Okay, some muscles aren't circular. Actually, there's very few that are circular. Most are parallel, long fibers, right? And these shorten the most, but they're not very powerful, but they can cause a lot of motion. Right, so one kind of parallel is the sternocleidomastoid. Let's see where we find that sternocleidomastoid muscle. Okay, I'm going to come down over here. Okay, so this kind of looks like a strap. Right, so this will actually pull on these two attachment points. And what do we call these attachment points for a skeletal muscle? Yeah, the origin and the insertion. And how come there's two different names? Yeah, because the two different ends of the muscle have different functions. One end is going to be stationary, and the other end of the muscle is going to produce motion. What do we call the stationary end? That is the origin, and the more movable end is the insertion. Okay, so here's that sternocleidomastoid. So you can see its shape, right? It just kind of looks like a strap. And here's another strap, and it's got two particular bellies to it. And we see the name sternocleidomastoid, and that should be your friend. You might be intimidated with that name right at the moment, but what the heck do you see in this name? Some things that you're familiar with already. Like what about, what's this? What's sterno referring to? The sternum. And what is clido referring to? The clavicle right here. And then this third term is mastoid. What do you know about mastoid? It's a process, right, on the temporal bone. So when muscles are named by their origin and insertion or by their endpoints, the origin always comes first, like the sternoclido part of this word, here and here, and the insertion comes last, namely the mastoid process. So now, just by seeing the name of this word, you know what the origin and insertion of this muscle is, right? So it shouldn't really be confusing. Sternocleidomastoid should be your friend, right? Because it has so much good information in it already. Okay, so here's a strap-like muscle. Fusiform muscles, instead of being like a strap or a flat ribbon, have pointed ends, kind of look like a stretched out football. We call that fusiform. And a fusiform, I guess maybe a dolphin or a whale has a fusiform shape to it, right, because the tail is kind of pointed. And the nose for sure is pointed. So let's see if I can find a biceps. Well, here's probably a pretty good picture of it. All right, so here's the biceps brachii, and of course it has two origins, right? It's got two heads right here. And then here is one insertion. And you notice that this insertion over here becomes very narrow. The tendon becomes very narrow. When it comes to a point, we call that fusiform. And even the origins as well, right, have pointed ends. So this is a good example of a fusiform type of muscle, not a strap-like muscle. All right, but nonetheless, all the fascicles are parallel to each other, running from origin to insertion. All right, well, let's practice this origin and insertion. All right, so where is the more movable end of this muscle? Is it going to be on the clavicle, or is it going to be on the ulna and radius? Ulna and radius. Which one is going to, oh, what did I ask for? I forgot. Origin and insertion. Which one do you want to? Okay. I asked for insertion? Okay. No, I didn't. I asked for the more movable end. I know, I forgot. Anyway, what's going to move when this muscle contracts? Is it going to be the shoulder joint, okay, more, or is it going to be the elbow?
Elbow.
It's the elbow because here is the insertion. The shoulder can move because this muscle does go over the shoulder joint, but mostly what works, right, is the biceps going across the elbow. But for instance, if I bend my elbow, of course I use my biceps to do that, right, I can also flex at the shoulder so the biceps can actually pull up weakly like that as well, because it actually goes over across the shoulder onto the scapula. Right? And then there are other muscles that hold the scapula in place so it doesn't move. So hence, these are nice origins. And those muscles don't produce motion. They're called fixators. Fixators hold bones in position so that other muscles can pull on them without moving. Yeah, without moving. That's a fixator. A convergent type muscle. The fascicle arrangement. Okay, for instance, like the pectoralis major, we have a very broad origin along the sternum and along some ribs, and then the insertion is on the humerus at one particular point, right? And so all of these fascicles converge to this one single point. So that's what we call a convergent. Good example would be pectoralis major. Okay, some muscles actually kind of look like flags, with a long central tendon with fascicles, right, that are going to come off at an angle to that central tendon. So a really good example, oh, there's a nice fusiform parallel. Ah, here we see some. And, oh, this is even a better one. All right, so here's the extensor digitorum longus. All right, I'll talk about this one a little bit, but here's that long central tendon, and then here are fascicles that attach to it, sort of in a transverse way. It kind of looks like a flag. And since there's only one part to it, we call this a unipennate type of muscle. Right? So pennate would be like a pendant flying off of this little flagpole right here. All right, so where would we have this thing? Extensor digitorum longus. All right, so somebody, just by the name, I don't see necessarily the origin and insertion on this muscle, but there's still a lot of good information in this particular name. Like, where would you start to look? It's not shown on this illustration very well. As a matter of fact, it's not illustrated on this little man over on the side. But where would we find this muscle? Okay. In your forearm, because it's going to do what to your digits? It's going to extend your digits. And go ahead, put your other hand on one of your forearms and extend your digits, and you should feel that muscle working. Okay. Okay, and it's going to be the extensor, and sometimes there are going to be a number of muscles that perform the same motion, and this one just so happens, is this the shortest one, the longest one, or the intermediate size one? This is the longest one, okay, and hence this name right here. So it works on the digits. All right, so that would be an example of a unipennate. Bipennate, all right, would be the rectus femoris. Here is that common tendon, and here are the fascicles attaching to it, but it's not just a pennant on one side, it's on either side of the tendon, right? So that's a bipennate, and there's a unipennate, and then here's that multipennate. For instance, a deltoid would be, oh, I forgot to tell you which one this one was. This is the rectus femoris here in your anterior thigh. And rectus femoris just means that it's a straight muscle. That's what this name tells you. Rectus means straight, and femoris just means it's in your thigh. Right? So, but it doesn't tell you the origin, insertion, or the action. It just tells you where it's located, right? And that it's a straight muscle. All right. So, and then here's that unipennate. A good example would be the deltoid going over your shoulder. And here, all of these are the origins of the deltoid muscle, and there is one insertion on the humerus, right? And actually, you know where this is. If I were to hand you a humerus, you could tell me exactly where this insertion is. Where would you say this insertion of the deltoid is?
The humerus?
Yeah, it's right on the humerus.
Head?
But what part of the humerus? What part of that humerus?
Right.
Ah, you know it. Okay? It is the deltoid tuberosity. Right, deltoid tuberosity, right on the humerus, which is kind of lateral, mid-diaphysis. So when the deltoid contracts, that causes, ooh, what was that motion? This is a review. But this is abduction, and this is adduction. All right, so the deltoid is important for abduction. So these central muscles are going to contract, but the deltoid is also useful if you want to extend, if you want to abduct and extend at the same time. The posterior parts of the deltoid are going to contract, but if you want to flex and abduct at the same time, then the more anterior fascicles are going to contract. So this is a nice muscle. All right, so those are some pennate muscles. Okay, muscle interactions. Let's look at some muscle interactions. I've talked about some of this stuff already. All right, so we want to become familiar with synergist muscles, antagonist muscles, and prime movers. These are different ways that we can classify muscles, and we don't want to forget about fixators. Fixators are muscles that don't produce motion, but they hold bones in a position so that there is a stable origin for another muscle to work on. So a synergist muscle is a muscle that produces the same kind of motion in the body. And they're going to be, by pretty much by definition, in the same body compartment. All right, so where's that biceps brachii at? Okay, I see that right in the anterior arm. And there's another muscle right underneath it, and that's called the brachialis muscle. And since they're in the same body compartment, they're going to produce the same kind of motion. I think this is pretty good. All right, let's go back to a previous slide. So here's that biceps brachii that we were looking at. All right, and we see that it causes, what is this motion at the elbow called?
Flexion.
That's flexion at the elbow, or you could say flexion of the forearm, either one. Okay, so there's the biceps, and then deep to the biceps, which we can't really see right now, is the brachialis. So let's get this biceps out of the way. And here is the brachialis. And you can see the origin is mid-diaphysis of the humerus, and the insertion is on that coracoid process of the ulna. And when this when the brachialis contracts, then of course that's going to cause flexion of the forearm as well, along with the biceps. Right. And you notice that the brachialis does not go across the shoulder, it only works across the elbow. But nonetheless, the brachialis and the biceps brachii work together to perform the same motion, so those are what we call synergist muscles. Right? So yeah, those are really strong. All right. If you have a couple synergist muscles, we're going to see synergist muscles working together in various parts of your body. One usually does more work than the other in a particular motion. If that one muscle is doing more work, we're going to call that the prime mover for that particular motion. All right. So for these two muscles, the biceps brachii and the brachialis, I would like for you to know that the brachialis is the prime mover, because it only works across the elbow joint, and indeed, it is a big, strong, powerful muscle. And maybe you would have thought, well, the biceps brachii is the biggest. You know what? And strongest. But the biceps brachii is superficial, so it's one that you notice more than the brachialis. That's the only reason. Right. And the reason why I don't like the biceps being the prime mover is because it goes across the shoulder. Its other job is across another joint altogether. But no, you know what? Your book calls the biceps brachii the prime mover. And I call the brachialis the prime mover for forearm flexion. Question?
So the brachialis, we move more than the biceps.
It's stronger, produces more motion at the elbow than the biceps does, because the biceps can also move at the shoulder, but the brachialis does not move at the shoulder.
But okay. two of them together reduce the flexion.
Yes, brachialis and biceps, and we might learn some others too, but the strongest one is going to be the brachialis. And hence, since it's the strongest, we call that the prime mover, even though there could be a whole bunch of muscles producing that motion. Okay? All right. So you see it underneath. Well, let's look at some nomenclature since we're right here again. Here's a muscle that you should have some fun with, the coracobrachialis. And remember, the brachium is your arm. Right, here's your forearm down over here. Brachium is just another name for this region. And corco stands for the coracoid process on the scapula. Right? And what is that, the origin or insertion? It's the first part of the word, so it's the origin, right? And the brachialis, the insertion into the humerus, that is the insertion. All right, so this muscle can do a couple things. It can help in adduction, and it can also help in flexion a little bit as well, okay? Because you can see that the coracoid process is medial compared to the humerus, so it's gonna pull it into the body. Okay, so your scapula doesn't move. Even though the coracobrachialis is attached to it, even though the biceps is attached to it, right? So what kind of muscles does the scapula have to make sure that the scapula doesn't move so that the coracobrachialis and biceps brachii can do their job? Yeah, fixators, that's right, some fixators. We're going to look at some fixators maybe next week or a week after that. All right, so where do you find the brachialis and the biceps brachii? Could you tell me what body compartment you're going to see these in? Like your forearm, your arm, anterior, posterior. Will one be anterior and the other posterior? Okay, notice since they are synergists, they have to be in the same location. Both will be in the anterior arm. If they're in a different body compartment, then they're going to produce a different kind of motion. All right, and that's what we're going to talk about next. Antagonistic muscles. Right, and remember, antagonism in terms of a control system is really a nice way to go. It's not if you have friends, right? But in terms of control systems, it's very important. That's how you control your body. Just like that's how you control your car. What are two antagonistic mechanisms in your car that you would never dream of driving without these two things, right? The gas pedal and brake pedal. All right, so your body has that same kind of principle in the musculoskeletal system. And so we know a muscle that causes flexion at the elbow. And as a matter of fact, you can give me a couple examples right now. What's an example of a muscle that causes flexion at the elbow or flexes the forearm? What's that muscle? Oh, please, hurry up, tell me before I rip my shirt. It's what? The brachialis or the biceps brachii for flexion. All right, but in order for me to have precise control of my hand and my fingertips, I need an antagonistic muscle to that. Okay, and where would we look for that? If the biceps brachii is anterior, where would we find a muscle that's antagonistic to it? Posterior, right? Posterior arm. And indeed, that's what we see right here. Okay, and that's what we call the triceps. Here's the triceps, so here's a posterior view. Here is that olecranon process, right? That's the tip of your elbow that gets banged every so often, and here is this big, huge muscle. And as a matter of fact, that's the only one in the posterior arm. And it goes, as you can see, all the way up to the scapula as well. Okay, so when this muscle contracts, it's going to pull that olecranon process, right, more toward midline, and that's going to cause extension. All right, so triceps brachii and biceps brachii are antagonistic to each other. Oh, that's, we got them right here. Just so happens that you have another biceps muscle. Biceps brachii is in your arm, and you also have a biceps femoris. We talked about the rectus femoris in your thigh. The biceps femoris is in your posterior thigh, back over here. So how would you compare the action, or how would you understand the action of the biceps brachii and the biceps femoris? Would they be synergists to each other? Would they be antagonists to each other? No. They really don't relate to each other at all because they're in what? Really distant body regions, right? They're called biceps because both of them have two heads. They have two origins. All right, so how many origins does the triceps have? Yeah, it's got three. All right, so you can see a lot just by looking at the names of these muscles. All right, so there are a number of different ways that we like to name muscles. Well, we talked about one, right? The brachialis that's in the brachium. So we name muscles by their location. Not all the time, but we like to do that. For instance, if you see this word costal, what should you think of? Costal ribs. I think we went over that. Like the costal groove in a rib, we talked about that in lab. All right, so intercostals are muscles between the ribs. So that's really handy, just in the name. And again, by shape, we looked at some by shape, like the triangular muscles called the deltoid, but we also saw one that was circular. What do we call circular skeletal muscles? The orbicularis muscles. Again, that's by a shape. Rectus means it's just a straight muscle. So we have orbicularis, deltoid, rectus. And so let's combine a couple of these. Let's say abdominis. Where do we want to find an abdominis muscle? Yeah, the anterior abdomen right here. And let's just say rectus abdominis. What kind of muscle is that going to be like? It's going to be straight, right? Just straight up and down, rectus abdominis. Right? I don't show that right here. Okay, sometimes we name muscles by their relative size. Like we have the extensor digitorum longus, and we could see the brevis and medius as well. So you have some gluteus muscles, and you kind of know where those are already. Right? And there's a maximus, gluteus maximus, and then there's a minimus. Right? There's also an intermedius. So all of these words right here tell us what the relative size is to that whole group of muscles. And sometimes they produce similar kinds of motions and sometimes they don't. Right. Direction of fascicles. Oh, here's that rectus abdominis. Yeah, it's just nice and straight. External oblique. What is an oblique plane? I guess we could review. What's this? And what's that? And this one? Okay, transverse. So oblique means not any of those three, right? So we could have some muscles like the rectus abdominis going straight superior and inferior, right, lying in a nice coronal plane. And if we angulate it a little bit like that, then they become oblique. And we do have muscles like that as well in our abdominal region. Okay. And sometimes we name them by layers. Oh, that's not on this list right here. Sometimes we would say superficial or deep for different kinds of muscles. Maybe they have the same shape, the same orientation, but one lies on top of another one. And then here it probably has got to be your favorite, right? Location of attachment points, like sternocleidomastoid. Is that your friend? Oh, absolutely, because it has so much information, right? So the origin, the first part, is the sternum and clavicle, and the insertion, the second part of that word, is mastoid process. Okay, sometime on the test coming up, and I think, is this chapter on the test? Yeah, it is. This chapter is on the test. All right, on the test, I'm going to give you a name of a muscle that you have never heard of before, and you might not ever hear of it again. I'm not sure. But you should be able to tell me what the origin and insertion is, even though you've never heard of it before. But are you going to freak out?
Yeah.
Maybe, but for only a short period of time, because what do you know? The first part of the word is the origin. The second part is going to be the insertion. All right, so you'll stay freaked out if you can't remember your bones, right? But if you can remember your bones, then you're going to know what the origin and insertion is of that muscle, right? So don't forget your bones. Bones are going to be helpful for the rest of your life. Okay, number of origins. Biceps, 2. Triceps, 3. Quadriceps has?
4.
Okay, and that's that big, powerful muscle in your anterior thigh. And then again, sometimes we name muscles by the action they produce, like what? Flexion, extension, adduction, abduction. And it could be of fingers as well. All right, so tell me something about this muscle right here. I haven't showed you where this is. Extensor carpi radialis longus. And again, and there should be a little smiley face after that because this muscle is your friend as well. All right, so what is the action of the extensor carpi radialis longus?
It extends.
Okay, now what does it extend? What can you tell me about carpi? What's carpi? Carpi, where's the carpi? Ah, I see it in the back. Somebody's waving sort of like that. Right, wrist, right? Carpals are in your wrist. So So here is a muscle that's going to extend the wrist. So what's extending the wrist? Is it like that? No. Extending the wrist is like this, or hyperextending. Okay. So extensor carpi radialis longus. Now it's going to be on one side of my forearm or the other. What side is it going to be? Is it going to be number one or number two? Number one or number two? Number two, because that's where the radius bone is, right? So the name tells you that. And what else? Longest, well, there might be a couple right there, and you're going to look for which one? The long one. Yeah, the long one, right? So there's a lot of good information in these names.
Extensor.
Okay, extensor? Extensor is going to be in the posterior forearm. Is that your question?
Lateral.
Yeah, outside lateral. It's going to be in the lateral forearm. Okay, and so if you see that extensor carpi radialis longus, there's also an extensor carpi ulnaris as well on the other side to balance out the motion of your wrist. Okay, so that's some important nomenclatures. Okay, here is something that's not in your book, and probably with muscles, if you're going to memorize one thing, this would be something really good to memorize. And this is, what do we have right here? Flexion. What would you call this column? Flexion, extension, they're all flexion and extension. If you're going to somehow categorize all of these terms right here by one word, how would you categorize this particular column of ideas? It is the, movement would be really good, okay? And in anatomy, sometimes we just call that action, the action of that particular muscle, right? So flexion is an action that a muscle can produce, abduction, adduction, rotation, all those are special kinds of actions. Well, on this list right here, you don't see any of those special ones, you just see some very basic extension and flexion. All right, so that's the second column. Now, what do you see in the first column over here? I see region, a location, a body region, right? Just a large region, like anterior neck, posterior neck, right? And what can you tell me? What's the relationship between anterior neck and posterior neck? They're opposite body compartments, so those muscles are going to be antagonistic to each other, right? Anything in the anterior neck will be antagonistic to the posterior neck, okay? So, you do want to become familiar with these different kinds of actions by body compartment. So, anterior neck is head flexion, like so. Then extension has to be posterior neck, like that. And those two muscles antagonistic to each other, but they're very important. They have to work together to stabilize your neck so that you don't break your neck. Okay, same thing for the rest of your vertebral column. In the anterior trunk, just like the anterior neck muscles, those are going to cause flexion of your vertebral column. In the anterior part of your body, like rectus abdominis. And where would you find antagonistic muscles to the rectus abdominis? Would be in the back muscles. Right? And in lab, we're going to see, maybe I'll mention that in lecture, the ones in your back are what we're going to call the erector spinae muscles. Erector spinae. They got a whole bunch of different names, but we're just going to know it for that. Okay. Arm. Where the heck is your arm? Where's your arm? Between your shoulder and your elbow. So these muscles, like the biceps, okay, what moves when your biceps contracts like that? Yeah, your arm doesn't necessarily, but your forearm does, right? So we're going to be talking about flexion of the forearm or flexion of the elbow, same thing, and what? Extension, right? Okay, so what do we have right here? In your anterior arm, these are going to cause, in your anterior arm, you know this, that is flexion of the elbow or the forearm. Posterior arm is going to cause extension. So you kind of see how important that is to know each one of these body regions. Anterior forearm, where's your forearm at? Between your elbow and your wrist. Right, and those muscles are going to control your digits and your wrist. So if it's a muscle that controls your wrist, flexes or extends your wrist, tell me the name of a muscle that will work on your wrist like this. Okay, it's going to be a flexor or an extensor. Could be an ulnaris or radialis, but what else? What's another word? Since it works on the wrist, it's got to be a carpi. Yeah, it's got to be a carpi muscle, right? Flexor carpi, extensor carpi, radialis, or ulnaris. All right, so anterior forearm, right, is going to be a carpal or a digit. All right, so let's think of some muscles in the forearm, right? And notice I'm holding my wrist straight, but what are my fingers doing? What are my digits doing? What did they just do? Flexion, okay? And then here's extension. So the flexors are going to be in the anterior forearm, just like the flexor carpi muscles are, but these are going to be called the flexor digitorum muscles because they're flexing the digits, not the wrist. The wrists are going to be what? Carpi muscles. All right, so if these are in your anterior forearm, if these are flexor digitorum muscles, if I want to straighten my fingers back out, what do I need? You need the posterior muscles, right? The extensor digitorum muscles, right? So the flexor digitorum, extensor digitorum, opposite body compartments. All right, now that seems really simple, but a lot of people can forget that very easily. But it's just such a handy thing to know when you're dealing with muscles. So I would just memorize this these two columns right here. Okay, so that's the trunk, neck, trunk, and upper appendage. And it's also good to know something about that lower appendage as well. And even the thigh. Okay, oh, I don't have thigh here, but I do have knee. Okay, so we have muscles in the thigh. These are going to work across the knee. Your anterior thigh, I better hold on, your anterior thigh, when that muscle contracts right here, extends the knee. Okay, it's a kicking motion. You can feel that muscle contract. To flex the knee, then you need posterior thigh muscles to do that. Right? So antagonistic motions produced by opposite body compartments. Is that what we have right here? Yeah, anterior thigh, posterior thigh. For leg extension and leg flexion. So if I give you the name of a muscle in the posterior thigh like semimembranosus, you can now tell me what the action of that semimembranosus is that's in the posterior thigh. What's the action of the semimembranosus muscle? Or the semitendinosus muscle? Yes. Yeah, that's going to be flexion, okay, of your knee. Okay. Or leg, very good. Across the knee or leg. Okay, now we do have some muscles in our leg, right? And remember, where is your leg at? This is strange. Where's your leg? Not where you think it is. Where is it? Between what? Between what? Yeah, it's between your knee and your ankle. Okay, so we got some muscles there. And we got some muscles in the anterior compartment, some in the posterior compartment, produce antagonistic motion. And can you remember, what did we call that motion when you lift your toes up off the ground? When you lift your toes up off the ground, like you move your ankle like that, lift your toes up off the ground. That is dorsiflexion, and when you point your toes into the ground, that is plantar flexion. All right, so you got two different kinds of muscles, opposite body compartments, and when you dorsiflex, anterior muscles contract, and you can probably just do that right now. You can feel those muscles contract, and if you're going to plant your feet into the ground, then it's going to be the posterior leg muscles. All right, so I'm going to do that right now. All right, so I'm lifting my toes off the ground. Ooh, I don't know if you could all see that. All right, and now I'm going to try to push my toes into the ground like that. I can't move the ground, so my body's going to move. Which muscles do you think are much more powerful, the dorsiflexors or the plantar flexors? Plantar flexors, because in order for them to work, they have to lift up my whole body weight, right? So if you look at all those posterior leg muscles, you'll see that they're very big compared to the anterior.
Is it the plantar flexion the same with the digit flexion? No.
Dorsiflexion, plantar flexion, these are antagonistic.
No.
And? Oh, digit flexion. Ah, no, digit will be just of your toes. Like here's the bottom of your foot, okay? So the digitorum muscles that flex your toes will go like that. The ones that extend will go like that. Okay? So it's just particular to your digits, but not your ankle. Okay. And I think you probably would know there is one digitorum muscle that is by far the most important and the strongest. Can you think of a digit that it goes to in your foot? It goes to your big toe, right? Because when you're walking, most of your weight goes on your big toe, not certainly little toe or even the rest of them. All right, so here is some important stuff. All right, and in your book, you can see some nice illustrations of that. Okay, for instance, let's take a look at I don't like that so much. It's at the end of the chapter now. Okay, so here we have a nice transverse section. And where are we going to have it? Let's look right through here. Right, mid-brachium, right across the humerus. Here's elbow. Here's elbow. So the cut is superior to the elbow. So it's really up in the arm someplace. And then here's one down in the forearm. But let's look at this one right here. Nice transverse section. So in a nice, probably a really nice dark red color. Does that look red to you? Okay. That's going to be in the anterior arm. We see a couple muscles there. And all of these are going to produce the same motion, which is flexion. In the posterior arm, you probably see it with another different color. Was it light red or pink or something? Pinkish thing. Okay. All of these right here, okay, are going to produce the opposite motion, right? So opposite body compartments. So what are these muscles? Well, we're familiar with these already. Posterior arm is going to be the triceps, okay, and you can see some divisions of the triceps. And then in the anterior arm, how many muscles do you see?
Two.
I see two. Superficially is going to be the biceps, and then deeper is going to be the brachialis. Okay. All right, so opposite body compartments, opposite motions. In the forearm, pretty much the same arrangement. So let's see, where's anterior, posterior? Here's anterior. Up over here is posterior. All right, so here are muscles in the posterior forearm that extend the wrist or extend the digits. To find antagonistic muscles, you got to go to the anterior forearm, and those are going to cause flexion of the wrist or flexion of the digits, and we see all the muscles right here. Okay, and if they're going to be medial, they're going to be ulnaris. If they're more lateral, they're going to be the radialis type muscles. Okay, and exact same arrangement for muscles that extend at the knee, anterior compartment, and in the posterior thigh, these are going to flex at the knee. Adductor muscles, right, bringing your legs together, will be muscles that are more on midline, more on the medial aspect of the thigh. And what about abductors? So these are adductors, medial thigh. Where are you going to find some abductors? On the lateral side, opposite body compartment. And we don't have very strong abductors, okay, maybe unless you're a skier, water skier, snow skier, or something like that. But these adductors, right, are pretty strong. And the reason why they're very strong is because if they were weak muscles, if you were to stand up, your legs would spread apart and you would just fall. Okay, so those adductors are really important to keep your legs underneath you, so they're strong, right, even if you're not an athlete. All right, and then the same thing for the leg. Posterior would be very strong muscles, like the gastrocnemius muscles, right? And in the front, we're just going to call this one the tibialis anterior. So in the back, that is for plantar flexion, and in the anterior, that's for dorsiflexion. All right, so body compartment is just a really handy way for you to understand muscle action. Okay. Let's look at a couple muscles in particular. All right, here is one. And again, I see a little smiley face. I see occipital frontalis. Why do I see a little smiley face with this muscle right here? Because it's your friend, right? And it's your friend because in the name is the origin and insertion, right? Because you've heard of occipital before. What does this occipital refer to?
The back bone.
Yeah, that bone in the back of the head, the occipital bone. And what about the frontalis? That refers to the frontal bone. Yeah, so here's a muscle that goes from the occipital bone over the top of your head to someplace near your frontal bone. Usually, a muscle has an origin and insertion, and both the origin and insertion is attached to a muscle. So when that muscle contracts, the bones just move closer together. Here is an example where that's really not the case. One end is attached to a bone. The other end is attached to some soft tissue of your forehead, like skin right above the eyebrows. So what is the origin? The occipital bone or that skin above the eyebrows? Origin. Yeah. Okay. I'd have to play the tape back. That is, when that muscle contracts, your head doesn't move, the occipital bone doesn't move. What moves? Your eyebrows are elevated. Okay? Elevated. That's what that muscle does. Oh, well, here's the key to my questions already. Too bad. Occipital bone is the origin, skin of the eyebrow, that's the insertion, right? So that's what O means, that's what I means, and then A stands for
action,
right? Elevates the eyebrows. All right, so let's take a look at where that particular muscle is. Here's a good exam figure that shows a whole bunch of muscles, right? So here is the muscle that we've been talking about, the occipital frontalis muscle. Here it is, the occipital belly in the back of the head. Here's the frontal belly right above your eyebrows. And what connects these two is a very broad, very thin, very narrow tendon. And a broad, thin tendinous sheath, like on the top of your head, there's no muscle right on the top of your head. We call those an aponeurosis. And this one has got a special name. It's called the Galea aponeurotica. It's just an aponeurosis. We're going to see some aponeurosis in different parts of your body. Right. So another name for this muscle besides occipital frontalis, which I like because the origin and insertion is in the name, is sometimes called the epicranius. Right. What can you tell me about epicranius? Why is that's not really a bad word. That's pretty descriptive too, because that tells you what? It's on the top of the cranium, right? Like epidermis is on top of the dermis. But if you say epicranius, you might want to be sure you know that it has two bellies, right? The occipital. So sometimes we call this the occipitalis. And then this part over here we would call the frontalis. All right, so I'm sure if somebody were to use that, you would understand what they're talking about. Okay, so occipital frontalis, origin insertion, very easy. What about sternocleidomastoid? I think we looked at that one already. Is that really nice and easy to figure out? Did we talk about that one? I think we did. Yeah? Okay. So, again, the origin is what part of the word?
Sternum.
The beginning. The beginning part is the origin, like the sternum, right, and the clavicle, and the insertion is the mastoid process, right? So that's a pretty strong muscle. Stabilizes your neck. Because you don't have a sternocleidomastoid on one side, you have it bilaterally arranged. There's a right one and a left one. And if they both contract, that causes flexion of the vertebral column. Right? If only one contracts, that's going to cause a lateral rotation. If the right one contracts, it causes a right lateral rotation. If the left one contracts, that causes a left lateral rotation. All right, well, your neck is pretty delicate. You got these big, strong muscles in the anterior neck for flexion. Now, what would you guess? What do you need to stabilize your neck so that it's not wandering around all the time on you and snapping and breaking? Sternocleidomastoid anterior, where do you want to look? Posterior neck. There should be some corresponding strong muscles. right, with the insertion at the same place, the mastoid process, right? And that's shown on this slide. But on the very next slide, you see some splenius muscles, all right, in the posterior neck. And I don't want you to know all the different subset of splenius muscles, but I do want you to know splenius, put them all together, and here is the insertion, the mastoid process. The origin is going to be the transverse processes of cervical vertebrae and some of the upper thoracic vertebrae. And now you could tell me, what's the relationship between the splenius and the sternocleidomastoid? Because they're in opposite body compartments, they're antagonistic to each other. Yeah. So that probably is one of the most important concepts that you can learn in this class. Okay, something about antagonism. Okay, so that's sternocleidomastoid. Rectus abdominis. Where did we have rectus abdominis? Yeah, let's take a look. Abdominal region for sure. And in particular, oh, this is a good view of it right here. Okay, I see a number of different layers of rectus muscles. Abdominal muscles. Here's the rectus. Right, it just goes straight superior and inferior. Here are some at an angle. What do we like to call ones that are on an angle? Oblique. Right, so the superficial layer of oblique is called the external oblique. There's an internal layer that we call the internal oblique. And notice that the fascicle arrangement is almost 90 degrees oriented to each other. So that gives a lot of strength to those different layers. Right, so they do complement each other very nicely. And then there's even deep to everything, there's a transverse abdominis. So you got a couple oblique layers and a transverse abdominis. But the muscle that I really wanted to talk to you about is this rectus abdominis. And I see that it has a number of different compartments. Okay, I guess maybe sometimes you see 1, 2, 3 on one side and 3 on the other. And sometimes you call that what? A six pack, but then you're ignoring these two down over here. Okay. Yeah, it really should be what, an 8-pack. Okay, so surprise somebody sometime. So these are what we call tendinous intersections between these different bellies of the muscle, but they all work together, right? And when this muscle contracts, okay, what moves in your body? Okay. The two attachment points are the pubic bone and the xiphoid process. All right, so which one is the insertion? Which one moves? Is it the pubic bone that moves or the xiphoid process? Yeah, it's a xiphoid process, right? When that contracts, I can't lift my pubic bone off the ground, right? Pubic bone is stationary, and it's the xiphoid process that moves. So xiphoid process is insertion. Origin is the pubic bone. Is that what we have right here? Yeah. Okay, and of course, then that's for flexion of the vertebral column. Okay, here is some connective tissue between the right and left parts of the rectus abdominis. That's what we call the linea alba. All right, so this is dense, irregular connective tissue. It's not very strong. And what did we say about healing of connective tissue, especially like tendons and ligaments? Tissues that are made from dense, regular, or dense, irregular connective tissue, if they get damaged, how well do they heal? Maybe compared to bone, for instance, which is another kind of connective tissue. What is one important difference? Does bone have a lot of blood vessels? Yeah, indeed it does. So it repairs itself very rapidly. These tendons right here really don't repair each other, right? So if there is a rip in any of these tendons right here, then you'll have a rip right there. And sometimes they can sew it together, but those sutures aren't very strong, and then sometimes they actually have to put a mesh in this area, right, to repair that connective tissue. And sometimes somebody will have a separation of the connective tissue right around this umbilical cord, right? We call that the umbilicus. And intestines can even poke out of that hole that develops right there. Does anybody know what that's called? When there is a rip in the linea alba around the umbilicus? Yeah, that's called an umbilical hernia in particular, because it's right around the umbilicus right here. But you could have rips and other places of this connective tissue, and unfortunately, even if you're really well behaved, it just won't heal completely closed. You can work on these muscles to get them stronger, but these intersections and the linea alba just won't ever repair themselves to the same degree. All right, here is another broad, flat, tendinous sheath. And as a matter of fact, there's a tendinous sheath that surrounds all of these muscles. They're in a little capsule. And what do we call this broad, flat, tendinous sheath around the external oblique? That's an aponeurosis. Yeah, broad, flat, tendinous sheath is an aponeurosis. And there's an aponeurosis around each of these muscles right here. Okay, so that's rectus abdominis. And now you should be able to tell me an antagonistic muscle to the rectus abdominis. Where would you try to find one? Posterior trunk, right? Posterior trunk. So abdominal, rectus abdominis is anterior trunk, posterior trunk. And I mentioned it before, and those are the erector spinae muscles, erector spinae. Okay, you're going to be antagonistic to that. Is that clock right? I guess that clock is right. Okay. Upper limbs. Some example in the upper limbs. Well, we've got the biceps brachii. We've looked at this, right? And I've got O and OO. What does that stand for? Yeah, two origins, right? And so the two origins, the long head is the supraglenoid tubercle. Do you have a picture of that in your mind? Where is that thing? Yeah, it's on the scapula, just right above the glenoid fossa. There's a little tubercle right there. So this particular tendon of the biceps goes right between the tubercles of the humerus through that intertubercular groove, right through the shoulder joint, and inserts into the top of the glenoid fossa, this supraglenoid tubercle. All right, and the short head goes to the coracoid process. Can you remember where that coracoid process is? What does it kind of look like? It kind of looks like a little beak. Yeah, it's on the scapula, kind of looks like a little beak. But, again, that origin also goes across the shoulder. So both of those heads go across the shoulder. And then the insertion is the radial tuberosity, but there's also another aponeurosa in the forearm that muscle attaches to. So we run into aponeurosis all the time. Radial tuberosity would be a good thing to know for the biceps brachii. And since it's in the anterior compartment, what's going to be the action of the biceps brachii? It's going to be flexion of the forearm, forearm flexion, or flexion at the elbow. You could say either one of those would be exactly correct. All right. What would be a muscle that is synergist with the biceps brachii?
Triceps brachii.
Oh, synergist? Ooh, I remembered now what I said this time. Synergist. What's synergistic to the biceps brachii? Okay, synergist. Okay, same body compartment or opposite body compartment? Same body compartment. Triceps is opposite body compartment. So what's another muscle in your anterior arm? That's the brachialis. Yeah, so brachialis is going to be synergist. And, of course, then what is antagonistic to the biceps brachii? Then it's the triceps in the posterior arm. And that's our next example here. And we see Okay, so a little bit more to know about this muscle. And it's the only one in that posterior compartment. Right? It's got three origins. And now here is some symmetry that I think you should be able to appreciate. Where was the the origin of the long head of the biceps? Origin? The supraglenoid tubercle. Okay. And the antagonistic muscle is going to attach someplace close to the glenoid fossa, and it's going to be opposite to the supraglenoid tubercle. It's going to be the infraglenoid tubercle is the origin for the long head of the triceps brachii. So that symmetry is borne out even in close proximity to each other on a single bone. Okay, the lateral head. Proximal posterior shaft of the humerus, right, and the medial is the distal posterior shaft. So this medial head is actually pretty short. And the insertion, you should know, goes right into the olecranon process. Where's that olecranon process? Who's got it? What bone is that on? Yeah, the ulna. Okay. So when that triceps contracts, it pulls that olecranon process superiorly, and that causes extension. Okay. Here's a muscle that we sort of alluded to, but we didn't talk specifically about, and that is the gastrocnemius. Let me show you where that is. Gastrocnemius. Okay. So here's the heel, right? Here's your calcaneus. So this tendon that's attached to it is the calcaneal tendon. Sometimes it's called the Achilles tendon. And this is the posterior leg. Here is the gastrocnemius, and you can see that it has two heads. One is medial, one is lateral, right? So here's the lateral head, here's the medial head. And when this muscle contracts, it elevates this posterior part of the calcaneus. It draws it up toward the knee. And so then what happens to your anterior foot and your toes? If the posterior foot is drawn superiorly, then the anterior part gets pushed into the ground. So here is a very powerful plantar flexor, right, working across the ankle. And if this is in the posterior compartment, where do we find dorsiflexors? Anterior compartment, right? And remember, those are not going to be nearly as strong. Like here is the tibialis anterior that will help lift your toes up off the ground. Here's the gastrocnemius, and there's another one that you're going to find, and it's deep to the gastrocnemius, kind of like the arrangement of the biceps brachii and brachialis. This one is called the soleus, but the prime mover is going to be the gastrocnemius. All right, but the soleus is still in the same body compartment. Okay. So, time for lunch. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. But do you have any questions? Questions?
So,
Some control the ankle. They control inversion and eversion. So those are going to be lateral. Okay, so posterior compartment are going to be for plantar flexion. Some in the anterior compartment will be for dorsiflexion, but also flexion of the toes. So I see these that go up to the digits right here. So that's going to be like the extensor hallucis that goes to the big toe. Digitorum muscles, right, are just going to go to the other digits. So since the big toe does a lot of work, it's got its own muscle. Okay.